Hi. Hello. Hi, Reason. Hi, everybody. Oof. Hi, Letlhogonolo. Oh my God, guys, Letlhogonolo wants a special greeting. I'm actually unable to. Hi.
Hey,
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm well, thank you. Welcome to the Cheeky Natives.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today? How's things been going?
Oh gosh, it's been a very long day. I'm homeschooling two children. It's just been tiring, but I'm excited to be here.
How's the homeschooling going? Do you have a new appreciation for their teachers?
I do. I love teachers. Like, teachers are, they're heroes. It's so hard. It's so hard.
Oh my goodness, I can't even imagine. I have a nephew who's 5 and he's got homework and things to do. I don't understand, why does a 5-year-old have homework? But I feel so sorry for his parents.
No, it's a, and my kids are 11 and 5. So there's a gap. So it's not like I can say both of you sit together and do that. I have to, vary the work and look after it and mark it and stuff. And it's just hard.
Do you find that the younger one is more difficult, or is she a little bit easier?
She's quite a character. So naturally she's quite feisty, quite, independent, can love to do things herself, and she gets on her sister's nerves. So I'm constantly trying to. You might have her join this call at some point. That's her nature. She might just want to say hello, and the older one is more chilled out, more relaxed. So
Okay,
very
so you're
different.
dealing with like two very different personalities.
Yeah. Completely.
And have you been working from home? How's that been?
It's not bad. It's not bad. Well, what makes the difference is the fact that the kids are here. So no, I work from home quite often, but because I have children at home, I've got to feed them, and they're eating a lot. I've got to feed them. I've got to make sure they're good, and so I'm having my work interrupted, and I think that's what makes it hard, And yeah, it's just tough.
Sure, yeah, that like having to be fed. I can't believe that I have to eat like 3 times a day. I'm just over my stomach at this point.
I know, I'm eating a lot, and I'm like, it's fine. And I'm not exercising, I'm not going out often. Days I don't step out of the house. Nowadays I'm just like, just at home. Like today I haven't stepped out, and that's not good. That cannot be good.
Oh, it's yeah, I'm over this. So I've just decided. I feel like I have a sugar habit, but my sugar habits is like worsened during the time. So I've just eaten so much chocolates that I've actually had to ban chocolate in my house. Like I've just had to take a decision to ban chocolates. I never
Yeah,
thought that
good
they would
idea.
come.
Good idea. I eat a lot of cookies and biscuits, and so I'm constantly eating, and I'm having a lot of ice lollies. I think because it's getting so I'm having a lot of ice lollies, a lot of ice cream, and I'm telling myself I'm allowed to. I'm locked down. I can make up for it when this is all over, and I don't know how I can, but thin clothes are not fitting quite well anymore. So we shall see.
I also feel like we're in the middle of a global of a pandemic. It's an uncertain time. I think that we can start worrying about our diets and what we're eating post this. But
Absolutely.
right now, I think we can just eat what we
Enjoy.
have.
Do what you can. Stay safe. Stay healthy. That's what matters. Keep your mental health protected, and just come out of this in one piece.
So I see everybody's online. Welcome again to another episode of the Cheeky Natives Instagram Takeover. We have a special guest today who is Abby Dare. I'm just going to read her bio and then introduce her, and then we're going to get started. Abby Dare grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, and has lived in the UK for 18 years. She studied law at the University of Wolverhampton and has an MSc in International Project Management from Glasgow Caledonian University, as well as an MA in Creative Writing at Birkbeck University of London. The Girl with the Louding Voice won the Bath Novel Award for Unpublished Manuscripts in 2018 and was selected as a finalist in the 2018 Literary Consultancy Pen Fighter competition. Abby lives in Essex with her husband and two daughters who inspired her to write her debut novel. Welcome.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
Yay. So, before we start, can I please ask you to read a passage that I think sets the tone for the discussion and for the book as well? And it's on page 21, the scene between Aduni and Mama.
Ooh, let's see. So I've got my book here, in case you guys see me looking down. I got the selfie stick that doesn't work, so I'm holding my phone. And I'm multitasking, as always. Let me see. 21. There we go. Yeah, from where?
From when she says, that day, Mama say. To okay. A louding voice.
Oh, okay. That's nice and easy. Okay. So I'm going. That day, I tell myself that even if I'm not getting anything in this life, I will go to school. I will finish my primary and secondary and university schooling and become teacher because I don't just want to be having any kind voice. I want a louding voice.
Sorry, Abby. I meant if you could have read from where she says that.
I was going to say, that was nice and easy. That's the easiest I've had.
Can we just have a redo? Sorry. Can I ask you to actually start at the part where she says,
That days. Ah, look at that. Interesting. So that day, Mama say, Aduni, because I didn't go to school, I didn't marry my love. I was wanting to go outside this village, to count plenty money, to be reading many books, but all of that didn't possible. Then she hold my hand. Aduni, God knows I will use my last sweat to be sending you to school because I'm wanting you to have chance at life. I'm wanting you to speak good English because in Nigeria, everybody's understanding English. And the more better you're speaking English, the more better for you to be getting good job. She cough a little, shift herself on the floor mat, keep talking. In this village, if you go to school, no one will be forcing you to marry any man. But if you didn't go to school, they will marry you to any man once you're reaching 15 years old. Your schooling is your voice, child. It will be speaking for you even if you didn't open your mouth to talk. It'll be speaking till the day God is calling you come. That day, I tell myself that even if I'm not getting anything in this life, I will go to school. I will finish my primary and secondary and university schooling and become teacher because I don't just want to be having any kind voice. I want a louding voice.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
And so we begin talking about the girl with the louding voice. So I love that passage because I think that it sets the tone for the book. So, you've said before that, you know, your daughters inspired you to write this book. So I guess the question is twofold. How did your daughters inspire you to write the story of the girl with the louding voice? But also, who was the audience that you wanted to write this book for?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think that when I started writing this book, the audience was really myself. And it's funny because I don't think there's any debut writer that, you know, any writer that has never been published traditionally or internationally that expects that her book will be picked up. And I fell into that category. I was telling myself this story because I really wanted to try and get into the head of some of the maids that I knew growing up. So I lived in Lagos for many years, for the first sort of 19 years of my life. And I lived in a neighborhood where it was very common to have young girls as maids. And one thing I noticed was that many of these girls, not all of them, but many of them were not very well treated. And certainly a large amount were not educated, so didn't go to school. Now, I left Nigeria, and when my daughter turned 8, we had a conversation in the kitchen where I asked her to do some chores, some housework. I think it was to help get stuff out of the dishwasher. And she threw a right tantrum. She was like, I'm not going to do it. I'm tired. And I said, probably many times. I had that look. Do you know that young girls that are like you, probably working for families like ours in Nigeria? And she stopped and said, working, like, what do you mean by that? Do they get paid? Can I get paid for what I'm doing? And I said, no, I mean working like as maids, and many of them don't have, you know, holidays. They don't live the comfortable life you live. And she asked me a question. She said, Mom, why would anyone send their child to be a maid? And, you know, I went to bed. We had a lot of conversation after that, but I went to bed thinking about this because it was something that, like I said, I grew up with. It was the norm socially and culturally. I had never until that point tried to understand the why. And so that day I began to research online, and I came across this article of this young girl who was 13 who had had boiling water poured on her by the woman that employed her. And in this article, this girl was like a blur. Her face was not visible at all. It felt like a statistic. And so I kept on asking myself, who is the girl in this article? And so the conversation from my daughter led to me researching, which led to me wondering who the girl was, which led to me deciding to write a book about the girl. So it wasn't just a book about the act of getting young girls as maids, but I wanted to focus on this girl who could hopefully be the voice of many of those doesn't understand her story and her journey. So that's where that came from.
You've spoken now about wanting to bring out the voice of this girl who represents a lot of girls whose voices may not be heard. And I guess this is a conversation that Clover Nolan and I was talking about whether in also the forgotten girls that we think of. Did you also maybe have in mind the forgotten girls that have been taken by Boko Haram and so many other forgotten girls, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I at a point when I was writing the book, I think very early in the book, I put a line. It was just to say, I haven't forgotten this girls. I think, and I'm not sure if it made the final cut, but I think I put a comment there that
I'm not sure. We'll ask her to. Okay, so we're just having some technical difficulties. I'll ask Abby to just rejoin the chat again. But in the meantime, if anyone has any questions, anything they'd like to ask Abby Dare, please just put it in the comment box and we'll definitely ask the questions. I will actually reach out to her and find out what happened just now. But if you have any questions, please. I'm just reaching out to Abby.
Hi.
Okay, you're back. Yay. Okay, I think we can hear you. Your connection is a little bit fuzzy. Maybe just move around a little bit.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Good.
Okay, perfect. So we were talking about forgotten girls and giving a voice to the girls that you felt were forgotten. So if you could just take us back to your response to that.
Yes, I was saying that.
And how you felt that the book did that.
Yes, I think I said that I had a point at the book where Aduni reflected, and I'm not sure if he made the final cut. There was a point where she reflected on the Boko Haram, the girls that were snatched by Boko Haram about a month before. So I started the book a month before a month after that happened. So I think there was a part where I didn't remember it. But as a mother of two young girls and someone who is very invested in the girl child, I constantly think about that. I'm constantly thinking about these girls who were taken out of school just for wanting to have an education and who were deprived of that right. Absolutely.
So the themes in this book are really, really difficult, right? And I mean, this is a coming of age, which is very difficult. Aduni has to struggle and almost can't catch a break at every point, right? And I mean, there's been a discussion about the coming of age stories for Black girls, which almost encompass the struggle narrative of being unable to catch a break. And, you know, there's been discussions about whether or not we need to reimagine new ways of writing coming of age stories for Black girls. And having spoken about wanting to elevate certain voices, what is your response to the question of writing a coming of age story that doesn't necessarily involve a struggle or difficulty at every turn, like the one experienced by Aduni?
I think that every author has a moral obligation and a desire to write what they lose sleep about. Well, that's what I do. So I could have written this. I mean, there's so many authors that are doing great things in that space. Tomi Adeyemi wrote a fantastic, I think it's YA about, the Orisha, sci-fi, which is fabulous. But I think that we should allow people to write what they feel they want to write. For me, I wrote this book in the hope to join people that have been speaking about this. It was in the hope to join a conversation that would spark change. It wasn't a book to try and maybe change a narrative from the way people write. It was really about changing the narrative about a way of life that I felt needed to be told. Maybe later on I might look at something else, but I think this was an important story. And I couldn't have done it in any other way. And I think that the truth is that many of these girls really have a difficult life. And I'm saying, I looked online, I think it's about, 50 something million girls, I'm not sure on the data now, that are out of school. These girls don't have life easy. And if we don't tell those stories as authors and writers, then who will? So I think there's a place for writing narratives that don't necessarily involve struggle. But I also think that there's a place for writing those narratives in the hope that there is a change. It's a way of giving a voice to these girls.
So this is a question that's also coming up in some of the comments. And I think it's like an interesting one to have about the language. Why Aduni speaks in the way that she does. And why you chose to write in the way that she did. I think that people have asked you about having used, for example, pidgin English as opposed to the English that Aduni speaks in this book. And why did you want her to speak in the way that she did?
So I felt that, so I tried to write this book in straight English, right? But it just felt like a feel sorry for me story. It felt like I'm going through hell, feel sorry for me. And I did not connect to that character in any way. And it didn't go quite far. It didn't go far at all. That it just felt like any other sad story. But also because growing up, many of the girls that came to live with my family and many families did not speak pidgin English. They had their own way of navigating English language, right? It was their own way of speaking. And depending on where they came from, so if they came from Togo, which is a neighboring country, or from Cotonou, or from their village, they would navigate English in their own way. And so I thought, why not, right? The whole point of being an author is to, as somebody said, break as many rules as you can. So I said, why not break some rules, give Aduni her own voice as much as I can, based on some of the girls I knew growing up that lived in my home and then homes around us, and have her come across as someone that you can, if she walked into a room and said hello, you would know it was her. That's what I wanted. I wanted somebody that if your eyes were blindfolded and she was speaking, you'd be able to say, this is Aduni. And that's what I tried to achieve. I really wanted her to be unforgettable. And one of those ways as a writer is just through that voice of that character. So I think that's why I did that.
There's a question. Well, actually, just to add on to that, there's a comment about somebody said they felt that in the comments, the book was written in Igbo and then translated to English. Do you think that's true for the
way? That made me laugh, actually, because I can't even speak Igbo. No, it wasn't. I went straight into talking about, I just went straight, once I knew that it had to be written in Adunni's English, I went straight into writing that. What the were parts where I wrote it in straight standard English. So I had a few chapters where I wrote in straight standard English. Then I went back and then word by word, I tried to say to myself, what would Adunni say? How would Adunni describe this? How would Adunni explain this? So I went back in doing that in some parts. But our English got better as the book, I think, kind of halfway through, as she began to, you know, get more familiar and speak with other people like Miss Tia and stuff, she began to speak better. So, but I didn't want it to be too sharp. I didn't want it to be jarring, the change. So I hoped it would be subtle a little bit. Some of your comments are making me smile.
There's a question here. If the book was made into a movie, who would you like to play some of the characters in the book?
I don't know. It'd be amazing if that happened. But I always say that is anyone who is passionate enough to tell the Nigerian story, because it's a Nigerian story of this girl. I mean, it's a girl story of many girls, but this particular character is Nigerian and she's Yoruba. So if we can get somebody who can relay that well and show the kind of passion that I believe the story deserves, then anyone that can do it should do it. I think it's the passion that matters. If a filmmaker loves it, I think they will be able to carry that through.
So I'm just going through the questions. People have a lot of questions. Lebaka Reason wants to know, in addition to Bukamuso's question on the use of the broken English, why were Adomi's interior thoughts also in the broken English?
I think it was, I mean, I couldn't have written an interior thoughts in Yoruba, right? Because no one would understand that. So we have to suspend a little bit of disbelief, I think, when you're writing fiction, and you have to be consistent. You know, you can't have her thoughts in Yoruba if only a very small percentage of people understood that. So I think for consistency's sake, and you couldn't have it in straight English. One thing I learned when I was writing this book was I remember somebody saying to me that if she could translate English into Yoruba, why couldn't she speak it? Now, my daughter was 2 years old when I was writing this book, and she was born in England. I think I'd only been to Nigeria once when she was about a year old. But her way of speaking English was almost like someone that had never encountered the language. She was finding the words her own way, and she was interpreting her thoughts her own way. And so I thought, okay, why not borrow from a real living human being that was living in my house and do that? So to answer your question, it was just to make it consistent and to allow for readability's sake, to ensure that everyone's able to understand it that way. I think it just made sense to do that.
Gums wants to know, what were your challenges in writing in that voice and in that way?
I think one of my biggest challenges was consistency. So how Adunni, because the whole story, I started writing in 2016 and it was published in 2020. So it was quite a while. And the consistency, ensuring that what Adunni explained, described as, I don't know, something in chapter 12 is similar to what she described in chapter 15, for instance, as long as she's still in that same pain. So it was consistency. And there were times where I got frustrated with trying to express Adunni's feelings in broken English when it was just easier. And then also using the similes and metaphors. Like I couldn't use cliches, which was good in a way, because as a writer, you need to avoid that. But I couldn't use the usual, it was white as snow, because Adunni has not seen snow, maybe except on TV. So I had to really depart from that. And it forced me to really think. I really had to really think about everything I was writing. I think that's one of the challenges I came. And then wondering whether people would be able to understand it as well, because yes, although I was writing for myself, there was a secret hope that I nursed that it would get published. And my first question was, I hope people would not just throw this book at the wall out of frustration because they couldn't understand it. And I hoped it wouldn't be pretentious as well. So I did have a few concerns and challenges.
So we have a question about the relationship between Mrs. Tia and Adunni. Do you think that the reason the characters worked was because they were both coming from a place of pain.
Yes, I think so. And from a place of loneliness and a degree of abandonment. Tia had her own internal conflict and internal struggles that she couldn't voice out to any of the other women because she just didn't feel, you know how you go to you meet certain people and you just feel that you can't be friends with them? There's not because they're mean. And I think that's how Tia was. She just felt she was very different from the other women. And then meeting Aduni and Aduni just coming across as she does, you know, direct and straightforward. Tia connected with that. And I think that on that afternoon when they met for the first time, I think she realized that this was somebody that will potentially not judge me and I can't judge her. We can just be ourselves. And I think they connected because of that.
This is a good question. So I think that it also leads into a discussion on some of the other characters in the book. So when you think of the relationships that the woman in the book had, and I guess also the connection between this relationship and the way that they relate to each other and patriarchy, what was some of your commentary around that? So how Big Madam treats Aduni, you know, or how Miss Tia is received in the environments that she's in. I think that there was a lot of commentary about the woman, their interior lives, but also the ways in which patriarchy shaped so much of the ways that they interacted.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I didn't set out to write a book about patriarchy, but it's hard as a woman that I am, that grew up in Nigeria, that grew up in Africa where there's deep patriarchy, it's hard to depart from that when you're writing a book about the rights of a girl child and how a girl child is perceived. It was important for Aduni to have a glimpse into womanhood to see that even if you come over the struggle of getting an education, you still have some battles to fight as a woman who is educated. And I think I wanted to show that in Big Madam, who is educated, has a fabulous career that she loves, but still suffered some of these effects. And that's the truth. The truth is that right now, there have been changes in the landscape, but right now, as an African woman, you have a battle to fight against patriarchy because of the way our society is. And it's not just Africa, to be honest. It's all over the world. So I wanted to show that. And the only way to show that was to show it from a point of view that was not Aduni's, from a point of view that wasn't poverty, to show that, you know, patriarchy is not based on the size of your pocket or your income, right? It's a mindset that needs to be addressed and looked at. And it shouldn't, I mean, I'm not saying it should be replaced by matriarchy, but it's something that needs to be balanced. These roles need to be balanced. This, you know, the way we perceive gender needs to be balanced and equal rights really for everyone, regardless. So I just thought to put that in there. And I thought it would be a good way for Aduni to see it on the other side, from the side of the wealthy, as opposed to from the side of, because she'd seen it from the village and it was good to see it on the other side as well.
I want to talk about the men in this book. And I mean, there's the men in this
horrible
book.
Men. Horrible.
Trashy. And all just like different levels of trashy, but just trashy nonetheless. And I want to talk about about the process of writing the men in this book, right? I think that the way that you've written the men in this book is twofold. There's a commentary on the ways in which men benefit from patriarchy and so have to do the bare minimum, but also in the harmful ways that men in this book interact with the woman, right? And the ways in which that harmfulness is really allowed by the system of patriarchy. So if you could just take us through the writing of the men in this book and the ways in which they are all just varying shades of problematic, but problematic nonetheless.
I look back and, you know, my mom was telling me that one of her friends, a man, read the book and called her up and said, look, who offended your daughter? Like, which man offended her? And that made me really laugh because no man offended me. I just wanted to show what was close to reality. You know, not all men are, you know, not all the men in the book are bad. We had a few good ones, but the truth is that from what I saw in my research on both sides, right, when Aduni was sold into marriage, she was sold into marriage to a man, a much older man. Mm. And there was no way, I don't see how any man that is normal and sane, and a good person would take a child and get marry them. So I just had to show that character in that way. And then when she gets to Lagos, I read countless of stories of abuse, not from just from the women that hired these girls, but from the men. And so I had to show that as well. So I think it was just a case of using the right characters to frame the story to reflect reality in a way in that book. It's not, you know, not all men are bad, but I just had to reflect that. So it was just something that I had to show to tell the story.
Speaking of the reflection, Kofi is an interesting character. But I also think Kofi leads me into thinking about the adults in this book, in the ways in which I think that there is almost a communal complacency, right? So even in the community, people are aware of the ways in which Big Madden is mistreating Adumi or the disappearance of Rebecca, but there's almost just a complacency in the adults, in the ways in which they navigate the lives of these girls who live in these houses and who look after them, you know? So I guess I want to talk about the character of Kofi, why you felt that he was important. Because I think Kofi initially just felt that he didn't want to get too involved, but he ends up becoming very involved and very central to the story. But there's also adults around this child who just divorce themselves from the reality of what's happening, will watch the child being assaulted and actually say nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that Kofi, when he met Adunni at first, he treated her like anyone else would treat, like when many, let me not say anyone, is how many people would treat maids, you know, welcome, put your stuff over there and start your job. But you see, Adunni was a character that has her way of bringing out the best in people. And so I made it in a way that it was because of who Adunni was, that was what drew Kofi to her, right? He had seen many housemaids, he'd seen Rebecca disappear. He was still complacent about it. And the truth is that many people are like that, right? Not everyone. In recent times, there's been a huge change, especially, I think maybe because of more social media, there's been outrage to how people treat maids. But when I was growing up, it was almost like the norm. Like you would, like, you know, like I said, you go out and see a maid and you could tell who the maid was in a family of four. Right? You see all the three children well-dressed and then you see the fourth person and you just know they're the maid. So I wanted to show that. But at the same time, on the flip side, I wanted to show Adunni's way of making people change in a way to draw themselves to her. Even Big Madam, with all her cruelty, towards the end of the book, had been touched. I wouldn't say completely transformed, but she'd been touched by Adunni because of who Adunni was. And I think that's, I wanted to show that the power of being kind, the power of helping to let even the worst people potentially be not good, but reflect on their evil, how you as a character, as a person, can do that with your own behavior. And I think that's what Adunni did. She kept on being kind to Big Madam. She, you know, kept on making Kofi laugh, and Kofi, you know, and everyone else felt that, look, we could help this girl because she's different.
So there's a question here from BK Offspring, and it says, in 2014-15, the house girls couldn't come into the church that was deep. Is that still today?
So that was inspired by something I read, actually. That was inspired. It was an incident, it's an incident that happened where a housemaid was going to a church with a woman who employed her, and when she got there, she was asked to go to the housemaid service. And so I felt I'm a Christian. I go to church and I just felt, wow, you know, that's huge. That's deep. Like, so I wanted to write that to show that that can happen. At least it's happened. I've read it. That has happened. It's not common practice, but it has happened.
Speaking of Big Madam and Adumi, I think that there's a commentary on class in this book that you've woven into the book as well. So the way that Adumi interacts with the Big Madam initially and her inability to actually recognize the class difference that exists, you know? So if you could actually just talk a little bit about class differences, about almost the shock to the system that Adumi experiences, and why you wanted to talk about class and class differences and what that looks like for somebody like Adumi.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't hear the last part of the question, but I'm trying to imagine what you're saying. So to talk about class differences, Adunni. So one thing I noticed when I was growing up, when I used to go on work trips with my mother traveled
quite often, and she'll go by road, and we'll pass through villages. And one thing I noticed about some of the people that I saw living in the villages was their happy-go-lucky attitude, their way to life was just not stressed. They just seemed really happy. And so when I was writing Adini came from a village where there wasn't a huge class divide. Everyone was, Morofu was kind of wealthy, but it wasn't the kind of, he wasn't even wealthy. It was okay. And it wasn't the kind of wealth or anything that made Adini think, wow, right? And so she had not seen anything like that. And so getting to Lagos and seeing all of this, she's like, she thinks it's normal. Yeah, they're comfortable, they're wealthy, but she expects to be related to as a human being. She expects Big Madam to speak to her the way people used to speak to her in the village. So she expected to be treated the way human beings should be treated. And I think I wanted to show that. But in Lagos, where I used to live, and I still, I still have family and I still go back every year, there's a huge class consciousness. There's a way that you see, people that are not as well, you probably are nodding because you know what I'm talking about, that where you see people that are not as up to you, even for the way they dress, there's a way you look at certain people, not you, but people look at certain people and judge them or address them that way. And so from Big Madam's point of view, Adini should not be speaking to her directly. You're not on my class. And so I wanted to show that a little bit and explore that. It was an experimental thing for me, and I enjoyed doing that.
Speaking of class consciousness, and also the desire to keep up appearances, I think that's something mm-hmm. that you explore, particularly in the, I guess it's the society. So the woman that Big Madam meets with, and they host events, and they don't particularly like each other, but there's still almost an appearance that must be kept up, right? And there's a class consciousness. So even the way that they interact with Miss Tia, who they feel potentially is in a different class to them because she has been educated abroad, she speaks a certain way, she has a certain education, right? Was also really interesting. So I'm curious about why you felt that you wanted to include the association of wives who are well-to-do, but who also in their own circles have their own negotiations around class that they have to do.
I think maybe because, I have a group of friends, some of my close friends, and I can see one of them online, a few of them online actually. And it's something that we talk about and we see, social media, people putting up appearances, and behind the scenes is not the truth. And I was just again exploring and just trying to show that a little bit in the book between these women. We all consciously, unconsciously try to let other people know that we're good, right? We're fine, we're good. Many of us do that. And we don't like to show our vulnerabilities. And I think that's what these women were trying to do. And this particular group of women happen to live in the book and one of the richest streets in Lagos. And so there's this view of them trying to outshine each other, right? They want to show that I'm better than you. My husband, like Big Madam lies throughout the book about how, if you haven't read it, no spoilers, but she lies throughout the book about how her husband takes care of her. Why does she do that? To try and let people know that I'm good. I'm in a good place. Mm-hmm. You don't need to feel sorry for me. And many times we do that consciously, unconsciously. I just wanted to explore that to see how, why do we do that? It was a question I was asking. I had a lot of whys in the book, and I tried to write my answers through the characters and try to understand. And for Big Madam, it was coming from a place of pain and a place of, I this is how I deal with my pain. This is how I deal with the marriage I'm in that is not working, but I can't let anyone know. Again, it all ties down to patriarchy as well. She doesn't want to leave her husband. She needs to let everyone know it's all good when it isn't, because she thinks she can't survive outside of a bad marriage.
So there's a question here where Between Two Worlds says, also on class, why is it that the middle or upper class kind of expect a certain performance of poverty, like how poor people look for a silver lining given their condition?
Sorry, how do...
So the person is asking, I guess they're asking, why is it that middle or upper class people expect that people will perform a certain kind of poverty, so that poor people have to look for a silver lining despite the conditions that they may find themselves in?
I'm not sure where the expectation has come from. I'm not sure whether I reflected that in my book. I'm not sure. So I'm not sure how to answer
that question, or maybe I didn't get what exactly they were trying to ask. So
we'll ask the same 2 worlds to just expand a little bit on the question.
Yes, please.
So Lotlokonolo says, how have people in Nigeria received the book, particularly in Ekati?
I think it's been well received. I've had a few comments from people saying, you know, I've had things ranging from thank you for telling the truth, thank you for talking about something that we, so, you know, many of us, like I said, it was the norm. It's not something you really think about. And I was quite shocked when I started to write this book. And the first thing I did was to Google to make sure that somebody else hadn't written it. And I was really, really shocked that no one had, you know. So it was. I've gotten a lot of thank you for telling this, thank you for telling the story, and for bringing it out. So it's been generally positive, which has been great. And my mother loves it. So, and my mother hasn't read fiction in about 30 years. So I'm good with that.
So, what is the purpose of the Book of Facts, right? So there's like things that are revealed in the Book of Facts. And I thought that was interesting that you included the Book of Facts in this book as well, you know? So what was the purpose of the Book of Facts? Particularly because a lot of the facts are a little bit, they're like not, I'm trying to find the right word, but a lot of the facts are jarring. They're actually a bit scary, especially the way that the book opened, you know? So I'm curious about what was the literary device that the Book of Facts was using.
So it's funny because that was actually an afterthought. So when I wrote the book, I had finished the book and I was going through it, and I felt that there still wasn't something for Adonai to anchor onto, right? There was, she just felt that there was something missing. And so I had it in I think she came across the dictionary or something, but I just didn't want her to come across the dictionary. I thought, no, it's not, that's not good enough. So why don't we introduce something that she can learn from? Look, Adonai's after education. Why not have something that she can be educated on, not just her, but also myself? And so I went about the very exciting journey of trying to find facts that would fit into each character, into each chapter. But I didn't want it to be facts that everybody knew, apart from the very first fact. So the very first fact was there to prove a point of how there is so much wealth in Nigeria. It wasn't about talking about a narrative of poverty, no. It was really about saying, look, we have so much wealth. Why is this wealth not divided in the way it should be? It was more of me being angry at the management of the wealth, and I didn't want it to be a political book, so it had to be something that, you know, that came from Adonai's point of view. But then every single fact that I chose in that book was for a reason. So the fact about the senators earning the highest paid lawmakers in the world, not in Africa, in the entire world. If we have senators and lawmakers that are the most well paid, why are people still living on $1 a day or less than that? So you see what I'm saying? So it was really me hoping that somebody somewhere would read this book and ask questions and try to change things. And that also that Adonai learns. But some of the facts were quite fascinating. Like the fact that Nigerians spend £59 million, I believe I wrote that, on champagne. Also to show, look, there's so much wealth. So it's not all poverty. We're not all, you know, it was just a bit of nuance, to show the variety of our culture, our nationality, but to also show that, look, that we've mismanaged money. And something needs to stop. Something needs to happen to change that.
There's another question where the person asks, in writing this book, what is the most important for you? What is the most important takeaway for you from this book? So I guess really, what do you most hope that people will take away from reading this book?
I think that the most important thing for me, and there are quite a lot of things, I try to say a lot of things, but I think the most important thing for me is that the girl child is not a commodity. That every girl child deserves, regardless of where they're born or the family they're born into, deserves a chance at life, deserves to have a basic education, at least up to secondary level. And it shouldn't be something that they are denied of everything else to be able to get that. And it's also to say that we should not be hiring children as maids, right? You know, there's been a lot of changes since then, but a lot can still be done. So I think it was really, for me, it was a message about the girl child. And that's why Adonai comes across as intelligent, as feisty, as funny. That's why it's really about the girl. And that's why the girl is in the title of the book, because she is the most important thing. And she's the future of tomorrow. And so I really wanted, I think that's the biggest thing for me, is that the girl child is not a commodity. She's smart, she's intelligent, and she deserves a chance to be given a voice.
So you've spoken about a childhood characterized by having housemates and who were young, who were girls, and you know, you've had some reflections. So I'm curious, in having written this book, have you had your own reflections about, for example, the girls who were in your household when you were growing up? Do you think of them a little bit differently? Was this book maybe also an attempt to think about their interior lives? What are your feelings now about having house girls?
Absolutely. I don't see anything wrong in having house girls, right? As long as it's at the legal age, the legal requirement to have it shouldn't be called house girls, you know, it should be called something else, not the word girls, because a girl should not be working unless they're maybe over 18 and maybe then they're a young woman. But as long as it's done the right way, as long as, you know, they're employed the right way and they're given the right treatment and the benefits that they deserve, it's a way of empowering labor, right? If anyone chooses to work, they should be allowed to, as long as they're able to, and it's the right way. So I think it's not that. It's the using of girls that are underage. It's the abuse that I'm against. Mm-hmm. And to your question about reflection. So when I was growing up, I had questions, right? Not my family didn't ill-treat maids, but I had questions as to why a girl would come into your house and work, and then after 6-7 months, they've gone somewhere else. Where have they gone to? What happened to them? Mm-hmm. And then another girl comes. So I know people that had, you know, 50 maids, then don't even remember them. Yeah, throughout their life. So they come and go. And so growing up, I had those questions. I had questions as to why they were dressed differently or why they didn't eat at the dining table. So those kind of questions. But it wasn't until I became a woman and had my own children that I could really think about that and reflect that. And I think part of that was my own way of reflecting that was writing this book. It was my way of trying to, like you said, go into the head of some of these girls and understand, you know, their journey. At the end of the day, we're all human, right? No one chooses to be born into poverty. No one, and some of them were not even born into poverty. You know, maybe something happened to their parents, like Adunis' family. She was poor, but her mother died. So if her mother hadn't died, Adunis would have still been educated. And so it's just a case of it could happen to anyone, and no one chooses that life. And I think that's quite sad if you think about that.
Something else that I found to be really sad was Rebecca's story. I found Rebecca's story to be one of the saddest in the book for a lot of reasons. I think Rebecca shows what it means for young women to be placed in positions of vulnerability, to be placed in positions where there is so much expected of them, and the same sort of societal standards are not enforced, you know, for the people who should be caring for them, who should be looking after them. And Rebecca's story is particularly sad for a number of reasons, you know. So in a story that I think in some ways is hopeful, Adumi's story becomes hopeful as it progresses. Rebecca's does not. Why did you decide to write a character like Rebecca?
I think, again, because it reflects reality, right? It's very, I can't tell you how many stories I heard of housemaids that have come to work in a family and they disappear and no one cares. No one cares about them. No one wants to know. And they, you know, sometimes these maids actually did run away and go start a new life. And sometimes they didn't. And I wanted to reflect that as well. The danger of getting people to work for families without a proper agency in place, without them being registered as workers, without them being treated as a proper labor force, right? That's the danger. Anything could happen and no one cares. And I think that's what I was trying to reflect, that to show that this, you know, they could disappear and be killed, maybe. Who knows? Who's going to fight for them? Who's going to tell their story?
Sure, yeah, Rebecca's story was really sad for me. So Between Two Worlds says, they're expanding on the question. So the question that they meant was how the middle or upper class doesn't understand why poor people would look for happiness despite their condition, instead of what people would think would result in them feeling defeated in the position that they find themselves in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess there's another question, I guess, that somebody's asked about what do we need to do after reading this to help our girls?
I think that for one of the easiest things to do, is basically, and that's one thing I hoped I showed that Tia didn't do. So Tia wasn't a perfect character herself. You know, she could have spoken up. I know that, yeah, Adjuni begged her not to, but she could have done something. And so one of the things that you could do is if you live in an environment where you've seen these things happen, these days there are agencies in Nigeria that are in place that you can give them a call and let them know that there is an underage girl working in the family. There are countless charities that are doing fabulous work in working with young girls and re-educating them and taking them out of horrible situations and conditions. And I think I will do something on my page one of these days where I'll, you know, ask the sort of tag some of these charities that are doing great work. So that can be done. And another thing we can do is just be kind. Be kind. Just, you know, it starts with yourself. Just be kind to the people that work with you, regardless of their age. You know, that doesn't cost much. But I think that, you know, if you live in a society where, and it's not just in Nigeria, it even happens here, where you suspect that there is somebody who is being taken as a child laborer, please report it and speak out and do something, because you might be saving a life.
So I suspect that Instagram is going to kick us out. If we can just borrow a few more minutes just to, I think there's like some important themes that we haven't really gotten to in the book. And I also suspect that people just have a few of their own questions. So if we could just borrow a few more minutes just to sort of wrap up and discuss a few more questions, that would be amazing.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So I'm going to leave this and then I'm going to start a new one.
All right, great. See you soon.
Just ask anyone who's got questions to please ask them in the next live that we start.